1261 and Senate Bill 1206 won't be heard today because there's some additional amendments requested by the sponsors. We will reschedule Senate Bill 461 for Thursday, February 6th at 3 o'clock. And May, what'd I say? Well, that would be interesting. It will be regressive. And on Senate Bill 1206, we'll reschedule for Tuesday on May 4th. Also, committee, next Friday, we'll meet at 1 o'clock because I hope to get through all the Senate bills at that time, and I think we're going to need that day for cleanup. Okay, but thank you. And but we'll hopefully have a forum here to finish our Senate bills. With that, we'll open a work session then on Senate Bill 504, and we have some amendments. Mr. Bowles.
504.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this afternoon representing the National Association of Independent Insurers, and we are pleased to bring you Senate Bill 504. For your reference, Mr. Chair, we will be addressing our comments today to the Dash One amendments, which I believe the committee council has distributed to the committee. Senate Bill 504 is very important in our estimation. It corrects some recent court decisions that we believe have distorted the original legislative intent of some statutes regarding uninsured, underinsured motorist and personal injury protection benefits. With that introduction, I will introduce to my immediate right Mr. Tom Mortland of North Pacific Insurance, and he will direct his comments to the bill and the Dash One amendments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Tom Mortland. I'm employed as a claims manager by North Pacific Insurance Company in Portland. North Pacific is now known as CGU North Pacific due to a recent merger. I am also an attorney and a member of the bars of Oregon and Washington. I graduated from Willamette University College of Law in 1976 and practiced law in Portland from 1976 through 1995. During my years of practice, I primarily represented insurance companies and their insureds, but also represented injured persons who were making claim for injury. Included in the cases I handled were a large number of claims for uninsured motorist benefits and underinsured motorist benefits. I handled cases involving claims for personal injury protection, PIP, benefits as well, although in my experience, few PIP claims were litigated in court or even arbitrated. As a result of my legal and claims experience, I am familiar with practices in Oregon for the resolution of claims for uninsured, commonly referred to as UM, underinsured, UIM, and PIP benefits. Senate Bill 504, as amended, addresses a problem which has recently occurred following a series of decisions by the Oregon appellate courts. In short, the problem is that persons claiming UM, UIM, and PIP benefits from insurance companies and their attorneys now have a strong incentive to litigate those claims in court, an expensive and time-consuming process, instead of resolving those claims through settlement or arbitration. This change is a long-standing practice which favored resolution over litigation. Senate Bill 504 encourages the resumption of that practice. A brief background. In 1993, the Oregon Supreme Court decided in the case of Carrier versus Hicks, the citation is in my written statement, that a UM, UIM claimant could not be required to arbitrate a claim for benefits despite statutory and policy provisions to the contrary. The court reasoned that Oregon's Constitution guarantees the claimant's right to a jury trial in such cases. Similarly, the Oregon Supreme Court held in Foltz versus State Farm that a PIP claimant could likewise not be deprived of the right to a jury trial. Before, and to some extent after these decisions, correction in my written statement, after the Carrier versus Hicks decision in 1993, the widespread practice in Oregon was to resolve UM, UIM, and PIP claims through arbitration. Although insurance policies contain differing provisions for how arbitration was conducted, Most frequently, the practice was informal. Each party would select an arbitrator. Those two would agree on a third for a three-arbitrator panel. A hearing would be held where the formal rules of evidence and procedure were relaxed and a decision rendered. The process worked quickly and well and contributed to the prompt and fair resolution of these disputes. Even after the Supreme Court recognized claimants' right to a jury trial in these cases, many claimants and their attorneys have opted for arbitration rather than filing suit in the circuit court and seeking a jury trial. This practice changed markedly in 1998 when attorney fees were added to the equation. In two decisions, the Oregon Court of Appeals recognized the right of a UM claimant and a PIP claimant to recover attorney fees in addition to the damages or benefits awarded. This was unlike the prior practice where attorneys were paid a percentage of the amount recovered, as in third-party liability cases. In Douglas versus Allstate, the Court of Appeals held that a prevailing claimant who litigated entitlement to UM benefits was entitled to attorney fees. In Cram versus Mid-Century Insurance Company, the court reached a similar conclusion in a claim for PIP benefits. In both cases, the court relied upon ORS 742061, the statute we propose to amend, to reach this conclusion. The response to these cases has been a dramatic increase in the number of claims filed in court instead of arbitrated or settled. Because of the possibility of attorney fees, attorneys who represent claimants for UM, UIM, and PIP benefits not only choose to, but are encouraged to, file these in court rather than seek a more efficient form of resolution. An example illustrates the dynamics which are now in place. Picture an auto collision. Driver A negligently hits driver B and injures B. In one scenario, driver A has insurance. In another, driver A does not. Driver B, the injured party, has insurance which includes required PIP and UM benefits. Driver B retains an attorney to represent her in recovering damages or benefits for her injury. Consider first the scenario in which driver A has liability insurance. B, the injured party, and her attorney present a claim to the liability insurer and resolve it, as is typical, through negotiation, possibly mediation, possibly arbitration, or possibly even through a civil suit which ends in a jury trial. In any of those events, driver B's attorney will very likely be paid on a contingency basis, the fee being a percentage, typically a third, of the recovery. Now consider the same scenario where driver A does not have insurance. Driver B, the injured party, presents a UM claim to her own insurer, and her attorney is faced with a choice. On one hand, the attorney can resolve the claim through negotiation, mediation, or arbitration, just as in the first scenario, and be paid an attorney fee, which is a percentage of the recovery. On the other hand, the attorney can file suit against B's insurance company and possibly recover attorney fees in addition to the damages recovered. The advantage and the necessity of filing suit in this scenario is being recognized by attorneys all over the state. I say necessity because to not take advantage of the opportunity for attorney fees on top of the recovery could well constitute legal malpractice. The consequence of these decisions is an increase in the number of lawsuits filed seeking first-party insurance benefits and a corresponding decrease in the interest of claimants' attorneys in alternative methods of resolving these disputes. Simply put, the Douglas and Cram cases have had the effect of promoting litigation. The problem I described has one other feature. Most insurance companies doing business in this state have offices in Multnomah County and can be sued in that county. Many of the suits being filed against insurers for UM and PIP benefits are being filed in Multnomah County because of the perceived advantage of that jurisdiction relative to the damages likely to be awarded. This is occurring regardless of where the insured claimant lives. The solution we propose in amended Senate Bill 504 is to eliminate UM, UIM, and PIP claims from the application of ORS 742061. The effect of this amendment would be to restore the practice of resolving these claims more efficiently through settlement, mediation, and arbitration. At the same time, this change would not deprive a claimant of a jury trial if he or she chooses to pursue that relief. Further, to adopt this amendment would clearly be consistent with the purpose of the statute. The Oregon Supreme Court described that purpose as follows. Quote, the purpose of the statute is to discourage expensive and lengthy litigation, end quote, from Dolan versus Continental Casualty. Most importantly, adopting Senate Bill 504 would promote not litigation, but rather the expeditious and equitable resolution of claims. I urge your support for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, before we take additional testimony, I know that Senator Shannon is here. So for a few moments, I'm going to reset the hearing on Senate Bill 504 and have you step back and then come back in just a second and open a work session on Senate Bill 1215 and invite Senator Shannon forward. Yes, and Senator Shannon, I'd like to note for the record that Senator Courtney is the one that noticed you in the audience. I didn't, and that's
Thank you.
She called me Pete.
He wants us to call him Pete. So it's not a pet name. thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, members, I'm Marilyn Shannon, Senator from Senate District 15, North Marion County and three other counties. And while you were gone, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Peter Courtney held a hearing on this, and I am thankful that you decided to do a work session. And that day that I was here, that Friday, I couldn't give you statistics, but with me today is Pastor Gary Hutt, and he is the chairman of the Ministerial Association in Minnville, and he has some things to say that I distributed to you a packet of information. And two things I wanted to mention to you is that Kansas City, when they decided, the pastors agreed, just without the law even, that they would only marry people that had agreed to a covenant marriage, which is premarital counseling and counseling if you're going to get a divorce. And their divorce rates fell 35% in 2 years. And in Modesto, California, I thought it was 35%, but he, Pastor Hutt has some statistics that say in 10 years it dropped in 40%. So anything that can help marriages last, I think is a good idea. And remember, this is totally voluntary. They can still go through a civil ceremony, and they don't have to agree to a covenant marriage to get married in Oregon. And so, Pastor Hutt, would you take the remainder of our 10 minutes?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Hutt. I'm the pastor of the Sunrise Church in McMinnville, Oregon, and also the chairman of the Ministerial Association in McMinnville. Three Sundays ago, we formally adopted and had a signing ceremony for a marriage, a Yamhill County marriage covenant that we spent about 2 years putting together as a group of pastors. The Ministerial Association represents about 35 to 40 churches in McMinnville, and 3 weeks ago, we finally came to the final end of our long process of developing this this covenant. We as pastors are deeply concerned about the breakdown of marriages and of homes in our society, and specifically for us, Yamhill County. And since up to 75% of all marriages are performed by clergy, we felt that as churches, we really need to take a solid stand on where what we do when we marry a couple. And what happens frequently is that I will get a call, for example, from someone who says, we're getting married next Friday. Would you officiate at our marriage? And I will explain to them that the only way I will do that is to have opportunity to counsel them, to spend time with them so that they can get to know one another as a couple. What happens, most often, this person will say, well, it's been nice to talk to you, and they'll go down the line until they'll find some pastor or someone who will do that marriage, you know, next Friday. And so as churches, we felt it was very important for us to come together and to agree together on some common requirements that we would have for marriage. And so we've drawn up this marriage covenant, which requires of a young couple or a couple that a minimum of 4 months of preparation. In other words, they have to come to us at least 4 months ahead of time if they expect us to marry them, a minimum of 3 to 4 counseling sessions. We'll encourage participation in premarital classes and retreats, such as faith-based Engage Encounter and so on. We will encourage 2 post-marital counseling sessions with a clergy or a mentor couples. One thing that this includes is that we'll develop a group of mentor couples in Yamhill County that this newly married couple can relate to. And preferably these will be couples who, such as myself, been married. I'll be married 37 years this coming summer. And so we've been, we've gone through some of the struggles that a typical marriage will go through, and that a couple can relate to this, so that when they struggle a bit and so on, they will have couples that they can contact and who will help them through some tough times. And so we will create a support system of couples whose marriages have successfully weathered life challenges. And then number 5 in our covenant states we will affirm God's intentions for lasting marriages. We will continue to extend the witness of God's grace and so on. And then we will seek to establish support systems for blended families. And then finally, we will cooperate with other congregations and organizations to share resources. These mentor couples, for example, will be couples from various churches and can be called on by all the churches that have signed this covenant. So this covenant of ours was based on several other covenants, the Modesto, California covenant being one. Corvallis, Palomas has, the ministerial association there has a covenant that I think has been signed, I believe, by 60 pastors. And wherever this has been done, it's been done in various communities around the country, there has been a dramatic decrease in the number of divorces. And we just feel that our society today needs very seriously to take a good hard look at what we do when we marry a young couple. For example, we'll spend great effort and much time in preparing a wedding ceremony. Just last summer, my youngest daughter got married. Many hours, hard hours, were spent preparing for that. But we spend very little time in preparing for the marriage that happens and that will take place over the years following that wedding ceremony. And so we feel it's tremendously important for us to let these couples know marriage is a sacred thing. It's an important thing that we need to take time in preparing for. So I would certainly very strongly support this bill that is before you here, Bill 1215. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. And for those in the audience, this is purely voluntary, the act that we're discussing. I was curious, of the people you counsel, what percentage end up not going through the marriage ceremony after the consultation?
Are you asking me? Chairman, of course, this is a brand new thing for us. We've just developed this. One of the things that we'll be using with this is this material called Prepare and Enrich. And the idea would be that all the pastors, all the signatories to this marriage covenant, which in Yamhill County right now stands at about 40 pastors, we trust we'll be getting more pastors to do so, cover such issues as marital satisfaction, personality issues, communication, conflict resolution, financial management, sexual relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And at least one of the pastors who had used it prior noted with us that a couple he counseled in a premarital setting determined that after they went through this material, they were just not compatible, and they decided not to get married at all. So, and we would trust that kind of a thing would head off a marriage that is basically doomed to failure before it begins.
Chair, also, Corvallis pastor, Senator Starr was telling me, the one that is at the college, after he agreed to do this, the first 3 couples after counseling, two decided they weren't ready to be married, and then one did go ahead and get married. So, okay. And I do want to say that we do have some amendments, but if you would move this along, we'll add them in the House. It just has to do with the county clerks. We don't want extra burdens, and the Yamhill County clerk has helped me write these amendments. So it'll... Yeah.
Good, because I was contacted by my clerk.
Right, no, it'll be $5 a page and all this. Right.
Well, after Cindy Brown.
Uh-huh. I actually have a couple of questions. Yes. And Senator Shannon, I don't know whether you're able to answer these or not, but I think there are important issues that need to be resolved. As I read this, I'm assuming what this does is basically get rid of no-fault divorce for those people who have filed for covenant marriages. So it only allows people to obtain a divorce upon proof of whether someone's committed adultery, felonies, etc. And I guess my question would be, what is the burden of proof that you would use
for
proving that?
For many years, the state didn't have no-fault divorce. Maybe it would go back to what had been established. I'm not an attorney.
Have anything particular in mind in terms of the burden of proof for the...
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, another question?
Yes, ma'am.
It also allows you to file for divorce if the other party, if you can prove that the other party has committed, has abused one of your children. But it doesn't say other children, only the children of either one of the parties. Would you intend to have it be so limited?
Well, I would think if you were abusing other children, that's a felony. You don't have to say it. Felonies listed another place.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What happens if the DA, the district attorney's office, doesn't have the ability to prove it? Yeah. These are more legal, technical questions. I'm just concerned that we don't have a whole lot of a new case set of case law.
What did they do before? If you abused your neighbor child, you could just go say that he did it and you don't have any evidence? Wouldn't you have to prove it?
I was saying it was before the legal counsel was born.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
know. Before they were, when we had grounds in Oregon, and I came in being as a lawyer in 1973, and I think
so that was about the year it was born.
Mm-hmm. That it was repealed. You had to prove grounds, and there was a list of what those were. They were pretty general. And, of course, what happened was if parties decided they wanted to get a divorce, they'd make an agreement as far as which one would be accused of the immoral act and the other one wouldn't contest it. And there were things when they're like desertion or non-support.
Uh-huh. The thing about this is totally voluntary. The government is not putting this on you. This is what you decide to do to be committed to marriage. You want to make it work. And I don't know if I said it today, but the other day when we were here in the divorce counseling, you have to go through the counseling to realize what divorce does to children, the betrayal feelings they feel, and all of this, and how important it is for a parent to stay involved with their children. They try to make it as difficult as possible to get divorced if you can possibly stay married. So...
Mr. Chair, last question. And on page 4, in terms of other grounds, they use habitual intemperance. What do you mean by that?
Don't you suppose that's a little legal term for a drunk?
Which line is that again?
Line 7.
That's alcoholism.
That's alcoholism.
That's right.
Intemperance.
Intemperance?
Intemperance.
What do you call that lady?
Remember the temperance
movement? The temperance movement.
But it talks about cruel treatment or outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
okay.
So sometimes when somebody's drunk, they get pretty outrageous.
Okay.
And cruel.
Thank you. Just making a record so that when folks have to start litigating these things, we'll have a clear understanding. They have before. I don't know.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Got a question?
Yes,
Jennifer.
I see on its grounds for... dissolution or separation, you have sentenced to death or imprisonment at hard labor. I wasn't aware that we had imprisonment at hard labor in Oregon.
You weren't? You think they're just laying around out there?
The implication being that if one commits a felony and has some lesser imprisonment, then that would not be cause for dissolution or separation. Is that your understanding?
Probably. This bill was taken from the Louisiana. Evidently, they still have hard labor down there. We have soft labor.
Another question is, on a lighter tone. Yeah. Don't you think that if someone was sentenced to death, that the Sildesco Duas Part proviso would take effect?
It might, but you know how long it takes for that to take, go into action. So, and maybe they want to be free to get on with their life. So, okay, thank you. Yes.
Senator Kearney. I move House Bill 1215 to the floor with a due pass recommendation immediately.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to thank Senator Shannon for coming and testifying and being able to handle these questions in the way that she has.
Thank you, Senator Shannon. Other discussion or questions? Objection to the motion?
I agree with the objection.
All right. Senator Burdick, please note as an objection. Motion carries. The carrier will be Senator Shannon, Senator Starr. All right. We'll now go back to work session on 504, and I invite the witnesses to come back.
I just some of the stuff in here.
Good afternoon. Sorry for the interruption. Why don't we take your testimony before we open up the questions?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Susan Youngstrom. I've been employed as a claims adjuster for Allstate Insurance for almost 15 years. Over 10 of those years have been focused on the uninsured and underinsured motorist injury claims. My job is to investigate and settle the injury claims for Allstate's own customers. That means I must obtain the medical records and any relevant weight loss information, and that will allow me to evaluate the injury claim and make an offer of settlement. We base our evaluations on the diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis that is in the records from the medical providers. That simply means we need to know what was wrong, what they did to get better, and what they'll be like in the future. Each case must be examined individually, as each person that is injured has a different physical makeup, history, and ability to cope with an injury. What that means to me is that your cervical strain for someone who's 16 years old and a cervical strain for someone who's 60 are very different things. When an insured is attorney represented, I must rely on that attorney to provide me with the necessary medical records so that a fair, prompt, and reasonable offer can be made. If the attorney and I are unable to agree on a settlement figure, the cases until recently went to arbitration, and someone else assisted us in making that decision. The attorney had generally received what was called a contingency fee as his payment from the settlement. That percentage was around 25% to 33% of whatever was received in general damages, whether the case settled or was arbitrated. In recent years, there have been a number of court decisions that have interpreted state laws that have changed how we handle these claims. The law before you has primarily been seen as relating to property losses. In a property loss, a proof of loss, in a property claim, a proof of loss is a fairly black and white statement. You fill out a form that tells the adjuster what was lost in the fire, say a 1997 32-inch Sony color television. The value of that item is not too difficult to determine. The adjuster then has 6 months to pay you for that item, less depreciation. If she doesn't, then the attorney can collect his attorney fees separately when he is forced to file suit to get the issue resolved. But the court has now interpreted this statute to apply to uninsured, underinsured, and medical claims, and we feel that injury claims do not fall into the same black and white value ranges as color televisions. The proof of loss, according to the Carrier versus Hicks case, that the injury claim must have is essentially a notice to us that this letter is the proof of loss. I provided you with a copy of one that I've recently received. The usual documentation that I need to evaluate the claim is not required to be provided with that proof of loss. A sample of the recent letter is attached. 6 months from this, the receipt of this letter, I fully expect to receive a suit filed against Allstate, a summons and complaint alleging breach of contract and stating that since they filed the proof of loss and we've not responded, that we owe attorney's fees from the date that I received this proof of loss. Not the date that I received medical records so that I can evaluate the claim and make an offer, but from the date of this letter. Since the medical providers cannot give us records without permission from the injured person, and we are unable to obtain that because the attorney is there, we cannot obtain the records, we cannot avoid the attorney fees, and we cannot make fair, reasonable, and prompt offers to our insureds to settle their claims. Since an attorney can file a suit and claim attorney fees under the statute, a person with an uninsured claim is suddenly in a better position than a person with a claim against a known insured party. The attorney can go to court, and if he gets $1 more than was offered by the claims adjuster, he gives attorney fees from the date he sent that letter. That does not mean the date he gave us the documentation. It's the date of the proof of loss. This means his client gets to keep all of the award, and the judge will grant the attorney fees in addition to that amount. There is currently no framework established for the court to use in deciding what amount of attorney fees will be on a case. A new attorney just out of law school can charge the same per hour rate as someone who has practiced law for 20 years. The attorney fees are often disproportionate to the amount of the award. I have had several cases in which the award was under $5,000, but the attorney fees granted by the court were over $10,000. As the law now stands, there's no incentive for an attorney to settle the uninsured injury claim. Some attorneys have told me they are even concerned about malpractice claims if they do not file the lawsuit, when the client could take home a greater amount if they filed that suit and got the attorney's fees. This means that more and more of these cases are going to end up in the courts, tying up time in the legal system. I have watched the number of suit files on my uninsured cases skyrocket in the last year. The trend is to file suits and not to even attempt settlement. It is my understanding that when an uninsured motorist coverage was passed, it was designed to be a low-cost benefit to Oregonians. It was set up to be handled by arbitration to keep expenses down for both sides. If you go home tonight and look at your automobile insurance bill, you will note that your liability coverage costs a lot more than your uninsured motorist. But how long the insurance industry will be able to maintain that is questionable. With increased court costs and now attorney's fees, the coverage cannot remain inexpensive. This bill is designed to remove uninsured, underinsured, and medical claims from a statute that was clearly designed to work for property damage claims. Physical items that have a clear value should not be in the same class as injury claims, especially when in the injury field documentation needs to provide provided to us so that we can make that kind of an offer. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the group? We have one other witness. Why don't you stay there? Because after his testimony, there may be questions, and it'll be easier than calling you back up. Nick Alexander, please, from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
We're all in classmates. I'm a little older. My name is Nick Alexander. I'm here. I'm the chair of the OCLA Legislative Committee, and I'm a practicing lawyer here in town. I have been for, I guess, coming up about 24 years now, and I do principally personal injury work, and I also do claims against insurance companies. I've heard the testimony. I haven't heard much talk about PIP, and I'm sure there's a good reason for it, because the statute, which applies to PIP, and in my opinion has always applied to PIP since we've had a constitutional right to jury trial, is extremely beneficial to insureds. And let me give you an example of a case that I have right now. And we've had a lot of talk about non-economic damages, and I'm certainly willing to address that. But we have a client. The client was in an auto accident. The client had purchased $50,000 in PIP, or personal injury protection benefits. So they had purchased the additional coverage that is available over and above the minimum that's required by law. They were in an automobile accident, which required surgeries. I have letters I could show you, but from two treating physicians that said that the automobile accident necessitated the surgery. Those letters were sent to State Farm. State Farm sent the medical records to a person down in California. That doctor in California, without ever seeing the client, wrote back and said, I don't think that the surgeries are necessary as a result of the accident. State Farm denied the claim. That's certainly their right, and there can certainly be a legitimate disagreement about causation. But now, in order to get these medical bills paid, we've had to file suit. And we've filed suit, and we've also asked for attorney's fees, so that at least there is a chance that our clients, State Farm's insureds, can be made whole. Because they're still going to have these bills to pay, they're still going to have it, but we could recover sufficient attorney's fees to cover those costs, although we're still going to be out-of-pocket expert costs that are going to reduce these medical bills
or the net recovery to our client. So 742061 has always operated on all insurance claims and not just on simple property losses. And I handle a lot of property losses, and there can be grave disagreements over value on those claims. So this is a very, it's just a pro-insured legislation, which is what it's always been intended to be. And as I pointed out in my written comments, the advantage that the insurance company has is that if they do have to pay attorney's fees there, and that they can spread that risk just like they spread every other risk, and so the insured, in essence, is paying for those fees anyway through his premiums. And those PIP cases are very important. UM cases aren't necessarily just simple and straightforward cases either. I have one of those I'm arguing next week in the Court of Appeals, and we went to arbitration. We requested arbitration. The company went to arbitration. There was a question about coverage. They said, we're not paying you all of your loss. We went then to circuit court, and now we're in the Court of Appeals. I tried a UM case 5-6 years ago. I tried it in circuit court because the insurance company did not want to be bound by arbitration, and so we went to court, and I won, and I got attorney's fees. The statute, I don't think it's going to cause a rush of filings. I know that arbitration is generally preferred. Everybody likes a resolution that's quick and inexpensive, but I believe if you have to bring suit against your own insurance company, that the statute was always intended to provide for attorney's fees and to allow an insurer to recover the full benefits under their contract, and I don't see any reason why that should be changed. 1997, there was a statutory change that made arbitration at the consent of the parties. And that obviously opened up the attorney's fee provision. That was discussed. There was a whole task force set up that discussed that and various other provisions. I was on that task force. And the legislation that made arbitration by mutual agreement is 2 years old. And we haven't even seen the effects of that legislation. So I think this is a bad bill, and I think it just makes it that much harder for insureds. I heard comments about PIP cases. You bet there aren't many PIP cases because you can't go to court or arbitration for $1,000 or $2,000, and the insurance companies well know that. And that's usually where you fall, and if you have PIP denials, is you have very small cases. And who the heck can go take a PIP case to arbitration or court? You can't afford to do it. And so your client just eats that. And that's not appropriate. The PIP is exactly like a medical insurance policy. And if your medical insurer denies you benefits, you can go to court, and hopefully, subject to some federal laws, you can recover attorney's fees. So, I mean, I think the legislation has been in place, like I say, for over 70 years, and I think it's supposed to apply to insurance policies, and that's all it's doing.
Couple of questions. So it would be your testimony then that prior to the carrier case and the Fultz case, you would be entitled to attorney's fees in a PIP case if you filed it in circuit court.
Well, the carrier, carrier is my case, incidentally, and there's another case before that called Molodai, which is another insurance case, and that's also my case. The difference is that the statute says that this arbitration was binding, so you couldn't get into circuit court. But if you filed a case and you brought up those constitutional issues and exerted your rights for a jury trial, then you would have a court judgment and you could recover fees. So in my opinion, although these cases clarified the law, it would always have been the law. But those cases are the ones that said they can't force you to binding arbitration, which is what eliminated your right to attorney's fees. And I'm not even positive that it necessarily eliminated your right then, but most people, I think, still arbitrate a lot of these claims. But the PIP claims are particularly troublesome, and they're just unaffordable. You can't process the claims, and you can have people in California evaluating people's medical expenses, never having seen them, and denying the loss. And in our case, we have about $30,000 or $40,000 in medical expenses, so we can afford to handle that, but you can't do the $1,200, $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 cases. At least it's very, very difficult.
But on an uninsured motorist claim, and if someone comes in with one, and you explain to your client that we could settle, but if you do, you pay my attorney's fees hourly or one-third of the settlement, or I can sue for you and recover the attorney's fees so you don't have any out-of-pocket expense. There would seem to be very few clients that would say, I'd rather have you file the lawsuit.
Well, you may file it, but that presupposes that all these cases are going to go to trial driven by attorney's fees. And so you're going to be in the same dilemma. I mean, they talk about a dilemma that you have to file these because you have the potential for fees. Well, the same dilemma, when you get a good settlement offer, that's going to put the attorney in the position of going to trial only to try to recover attorney's fees. These cases are all going to settle, or 99% of them are going to settle the same way they have. 99% of them have settled for the 24 years I've been in practice. Maybe 98% of them will settle now instead of 99%. But settlement is preferable for everyone. Plaintiffs, attorneys, plaintiffs, everybody wants to settle. And the settlements will still take place. There's no rash of these cases that are getting to the courthouse. There may be more filed, but there's no rash of them that are actually getting to trial, at least in my opinion. And, of course, we don't have enough history to even make a judgment on that.
Well, you mentioned the work group from 97, and of course the bill that came out of that was the bill I sponsored on uninsured motorists, and I'm trying to recall, and it was a big work group. I'm trying to recall if this was discussed, and I have no recollection one way or another on it.
And I can't, honestly, Senator, I can't tell you if it was discussed or not. I mean, it may have been an issue in my mind, but I can't tell you honestly that we talked about it. The effect, I think, should have been apparent.
Well, maybe another option would be to provide that before you can recover attorney's fees, that you have to complete a claim and that the insurance company has an opportunity to make an offer. In order to recover attorney's fees, you'd have to beat that offer. What do you think that is an option?
Well, you already have the statute is set up to make a tender, and in the recent Supreme Court opinions, those tenders have even been available up until the time of trial and have cut off attorney's fees. That case is under review now, but that case was decided last year. I mean, I would sympathize certainly with the adjuster who says I get a proof of loss, but it has nothing with it. But medicals are normally provided, at least in my practice and in my office. I mean, if we're going to process a claim, we know that ultimately the insurance company or the defense attorney is entitled to medicals and full disclosure, and we give that. And we're going to give that in an attempt to settle the claim. And I believe in the PIP cases that when you fill out a PIP application, and I may be wrong, that you authorize the company to get your medical expenses, I mean your medical records.
Mr. Mortland, do you see a distinction between the past history on PIP and the uninsured motorist?
Mr. Chairman, is your question directed to the distinction before these cases were decided? Again, in my experience, and to some extent, I think Mr. Alexander and I are both relating our experience, which is familiarity with the practice of the law in the state of Oregon. And my experience was that with PIP cases, very few of those were arbitrated or litigated because the amounts in dispute were relatively small, and it was much more it was possible to resolve that quickly either by settlement or through some sort of a mediation or arbitration process. Arbitration has always been available. Again, in my experience, the uninsured motorist claims or underinsured motorist claims more typically were arbitrated because it was, in effect, a short and simple trial of the case that allowed a three-party panel to make a decision and hopefully award from the plaintiff's perspective more than the company had offered. So there was that distinction. But in terms of the assumption that everyone made, as Mr. Alexander points out, once these cases are decided, we can look back and say that was always the state of the law. But I can assert with some confidence that practitioners out there didn't assume that to be the state of the law. It was widely assumed that these cases did have to be arbitrated or otherwise negotiated, both PIP and UM cases.
Good question.
And the uninsured motorist, is there a cap? I mean, do you have, like, property limits or injury limits, or is there a standard thing in the policies?
If, for example, the person had a 25 policy and they went to court and they got a $25,000 award and then the attorney's fees were $15,000 or $30,000 on top of that, that's paid in addition to what their limits were.
Okay, in addition. But is there a standard policy? Is there a limit or a cap on uninsured motorists? No, on uninsured motorists.
The minimum you can buy, that you have to buy in Oregon is $25,000.
The minimum you have to buy. Okay. That's
other questions? Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for your testimony. We'll bring this one back next week. So we adjourn the public or the work session on Senate Bill 504. And what should be next here? All right, we'll now open the work session on Senate Bill 1019, and we have some conceptual amendments or early drafts.
We have
some
drafts.
All right. If you would explain, John, why don't you come forward? John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company. Senate Bill 1019 was, we had a very brief hearing on it one day, and I wanted to describe just in general what the what this bill would do. You have in front of you at least dash four amendments, and then there is one conceptual amendment those dash four amendments that staff can help me with a little later. The Senate Bill 1019 creates, like the banking industry, a self-audit evaluation privilege in the law, which simply means that a highly regulated industry like banking or insurance is required to live under a ton of rules, regulations, and laws. What a self-compliant audit is aimed at doing is to make sure that the insurer, in this case, is abiding by those laws. Unfortunately, there have been cases where people will simply wait until an insurer completes one of these audits, subpoena that, and file a lawsuit based on it. What Section 3 of the bill does on page 2 is it creates a privilege against the use of this audit as evidence in a civil, criminal, or administrative proceedings. That's the heart of the bill, is to create that kind of privilege. And as I said, this privilege exists in a very similar way with banking. On page 1 of the amendment, an insurance compliance audit is defined. And again, it is an undertaking to identify or prevent noncompliance with or promote compliance with laws, regulations, orders, or industry or professional standards. So the thrust of what an insurance compliance audit is in that definition is compliance with the law. The definition of a insurance compliance document is in subsection 2, and again, it's the key to that definition is down at the bottom of that page on the next to the last line where it says it is information collected or developed solely for the purpose of this audit. Again, so that a regulated entity could not use this audit as a shield in any way to shield tons of information. It just simply has to be information that was collected or developed solely for the purpose of this audit. As I said before, Section 3 of the bill creates the privilege against the use of this audit in an action against the insurer in a civil or criminal proceeding. Section 4 of the bill is very important in that this assures that the regulator, in this case the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, may acquire either by requesting it or voluntarily by the insurer, this self-evaluation audit. So again, we're not shielding this information, even that the insurer did on their own business, from the regulator. The regulator has a right to that information. And the director, while it's in the director's hands, however, it is still subject to RS 192 and not subject to disclosure. And in fact, it's still owned by the insurer as the regulator looks at it. What we've tried to do in this bill with the insurance division's assistance is to make sure that the regulator is not hampered in any way by the creation of this privilege. This also allows for in-camera review in a court to determine whether or not the document is subject to the privilege. So if somebody alleges that this document should not be protected under this privilege, it is subject to an in-camera review by the court to make that determination. Then, Mr. Chairman, with that, I think I'll stop and answer any questions that the committee might have.
John, what was the conceptual amendment that needs to be made again? Or, again, can you point that out?
Mr. Chair, on page 5 of the dash 4 amendment, line 23, it's deleting subsection 3, the reference to subsection 3. The elements for proving the privilege are actually contained in all of section 5, not just the limited subsection of 5.
All right. That's an easy one. The chair then would move the conceptual amendment of deleting subparagraph 3 on page 5, line 23 of the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 1019. Discussion and direction to the orders. Are there any questions of Mr. Powell? If not, the chair then would move the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 1019 as conceptually amended to the floor, or to the bill. Discussion, objection, to order. The chair then would move Senate Bill 1019 as amended to the floor, do pass. Discussion, objection, ordered, all carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, if I might just add my thanks to Nancy Ellison at the Insurance Division, Delario, and Lewis Littlehales for their work in helping from the regulator's point of view on this bill, because it wouldn't have been possible without their assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. And
yes.
Yes.
I'll be an aye vote.
Thank you. Please record Senator Brown's aye vote. And we're missing two of our members and maybe three because of the Legislative Council meeting. Are you on Legislative Council, Kate? Okay.
No, it's me.
I am too.
Well, you guys can't all go. Sure. It's my quorum.
I'm going.
We'll just do it. You go.
One of the two of you may go.
Can you go ahead?
Okay. I'll make sure.
That's okay.
We need to keep quorum. All right. We'll now open the work session on Senate Bill 236, and we have the dash 9 amendments. And
we do. Mr. Chair and Farthy, we're not handing gross. we stopped at the handing gross in the 4 times. But in any event, the dash 9 just came to us this afternoon. And if you recall, what the bill does is provide some technical cleanup, if you will, to Senate Bill 235, which standardized last session the disciplinary practices and disclosure of information that health professional regulatory boards collect in the course of their investigation of licensees and applicants. And specifically, Senate Bill 236, which as originally drafted was introduced by the Attorney General's office to, well, actually, no, it wasn't. It was introduced by this committee to clarify a few instances where Senate Bill 235 actually tied the hands of agencies who look to share information with each other regarding investigations that they may be performing. So you'll note in Section 2 of the bill, it permits boards to share information with each other related to investigations and regulatory enforcement functions that they are responsible for, and defines the public entities that can actually share information by the amendment rather broadly, in that it's a board or agency of this state or another of the federal government, district attorney, Department of Justice, and law enforcement agency of this state or another. In addition, the Dash 9 amendments, if you look at lines 11 on the first page, permits the board to disclose to the complainant a written summary of information that it obtained as part of the investigation. Right now, the board had brought to your attention the fact that they were hampered in terms of what they could say to a complainant with regard to an investigation that they were performing upon a complainant's complaint, or after a complainant's complaint. In line 20 through 24 on page 1 and a few lines following on page 2, there's the clarification that public officials and members of the press may attend an executive session and are not to disclose information that they obtain in the course of that. And then the other language I want to bring to your attention that we haven't discussed yet is on page 5, section 5, subsection 5, that currently if a licensee of the Board of Medical Examiners is subject to investigation or complaint, the board is to provide the licensee with a summary of that complaint before they appear before the board. And in addition, the new language would require the board at that same time to provide the licensee a current summary of documents or alleged facts that they have obtained as a result of the investigation. In doing so, may redact the name of the complainant or information that they reasonably used to identify the complainant. Then on page 5, line 7, and the top of page 6, specification there that except in proceedings conducted by the board or in proceedings or investigations to which a public entity is a party, that licensees won't be questioned or examined regarding communications that they made as part of an appearance before the board. I believe we discussed the case in Klamath Falls in the last public hearing, and there was some concern that what the physician had actually said before the board, he was then questioned about in a subsequent civil action. There is specification there that that section doesn't prohibit the examination of a licensee regarding the patient's records or regarding the medical records or records dealing with the patient's care and treatment. And provide the same language for the licensees of the Board of Dentistry and I am at a loss right now to point that out to you.
Committee, this is one that we've worked, had several meetings, exchanged letters, and we have an agreement in principle between the Attorney General's Office, the Oregon Medical Association, and the DME. And so on the Dash 9, none of them are entirely happy, but in part it was the chair of the committee, Wayne Solomon, and Green, that I thought would make the best public policy in accomplishing the spirit of what we tried to accomplish last year in 235. So.
I had some amendments drafted about 2 months ago that dealt with allowing the boards to put the information on the Internet, not making it mandatory, but allowing them to do so. And I don't see it happening. I was just going to call LC and see if they had them, but I assumed everybody had copies. So.
My
recollection is Dash 2.
Senator Brown, would you mind if... we move the bill and if you want to put that on the House side.
Okay, as long as I have your seal of approval, I'm happy to do that.
All right. So the chair then, unless there's any questions, would move the Dash 9 amendment, Senate Bill 236, discussion, objection, so order. The chair then would move Senate Bill 236 before due pass, discussion, objection, carries. I will carry this bill. And hopefully in the next session, no one will have to come back and... We will now go into a work session on Senate Bill 937 and 108, and
I would invite Jim Gardner, Jim Mathis, Bruce Bishop, and Brad Popovich for it. And again, there's been a hard work by both parties on this. There is some agreement to portions of it, but not on a major policy issue. So I've asked the parties to explain to us what they do agree on and then outline in terms that we can understand the issues that divide them, and then we'll make a decision. So, gentlemen, who would like to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I would, at the cost of disagreeing with the chair, I think that we do have agreement on the major policy issues. I think that the sheet that is in front of you, through your own strenuous encouragement to the parties,
I put them in a room together
to get together and to really think through this, and with the tremendous work on behalf of OHSU, OGPAC, Kaiser, and other interested parties, I think we have come away with the five consensus items which are now before you. Won't read through those, but which I think represent the real heart and soul of this, of the thrust of the legislative initiative on both sides. We do have some drafting yet to do in terms of turning this into correct statutory language, but I think this represents a very substantial agreement in principle on the heart and soul of the genetic privacy improvement initiative. I guess, and I'd beg your indulgence to perhaps be able to come back. We suggested to Ann that this be noticed for work session both Tuesday and Thursday, so that we can come back hopefully with a ready to go package for you.
Okay.
Jim Gardner, representing Pharma.
So, thank you. Just so the committee understands, because this is highly technical, I looking at the consensus points, and I do appreciate your hard work on accomplishing these.
Hi, Gina.
Well, you've come further than I thought, because I thought a couple
of
these were still in dispute. So, all right, I understand the five consensus points. Does the committee have any questions on those? All right. Why don't we then talk about, and is your idea not to talk about what still is in disagreement and come back on Tuesday and Thursday?
You know, I want to emphasize the positive, and I think that, you know, we can maybe, I think that if you can sort of keep us shoved toward a pathway of building on this, fleshing this in, consensus approach, that's, you know, I think that really is the most fruitful approach, but, you know, the panel, whoever wants to say.
Mr. Mathis, Mr. Bishop, Dr. Popovich, do you have anything you want to add at this point? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Mattis, counsel at Oregon Health Sciences University, I think I would like to put the same spin that Mr. Gardner has put on it. It's not been easy to come to a consensus to even articulate that upon which we have made consensus. And the devil, of course, will be in the details when we actually come forth with a bill. But I think that's what we would like to do. These go more than care for my institution's direct specific needs in terms of expanding the definition of anonymous research. And we're supportive of all of them. We would urge you, however, to not discard some of the other interests that Senate Bill 1008 did seek to try to do, even though, and one of the reasons that it's more complex is because it tried to care for the interests of the insurance commissioner, the health division, and others, and in a cleanup sort of way that would improve the law. And we don't think those are things that are particularly controversial, and you ought not to lose track of them.
And as we go through this, and this is one that returns each session to us, beginning in 1995 when we were the first state to adopt laws in genetic privacy, with technology changing and what other states are doing and what federal governments are doing, this is one that's going to come back each session. I mean, it's as Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again.
And so I know whoever will be in charge of this committee next time will see your smiling faces again. But on some of the issues, it might even be helpful to, as we go through the interim judiciary committee, to talk about some of these things. And as we come to closure on these two bills, tell me if I'm wrong again, but the idea is to have one bill, correct? And have you selected the vehicle of what that one bill will be?
I don't think that's really, I don't think the number is, it's certainly of no consequence to us. It's the substance is what matters to us.
If you would decide that, because you need to draft amendments, of course, that will be, and if you can't agree, flip a coin and says, so that would be good. Prof. Fitch, do you have anything that you'd like to say?
Yes, thank you. I think we have come a long way. I think there's these five consensus points demonstrate that both groups are willing to move considerably. I'm here today as the chair of the Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee, but I have to be honest with you and say that the advisory committee has not even seen these five elements yet. They literally came to us on the drive down in the car today. So we do agree with those. We put our name on those. But I just want to back up for a minute and talk for just a moment on the legislative intent, and then to talk just a little bit about, I think, the matter of the vehicle to accomplish this. The legislative intent is clearly spelled out in the current law. I mean, it makes very clear what the intention of the law is. And really what we need to do, though, is to reinforce the message that that the law was really intended to deal with people undergoing medical testing that would, by chance, be a genetic test that was used for medical purposes, and that test was ordered by a physician. And the problem was, the reason we drafted this law in 1995, and I was one of the people responsible for this, was that people were being harmed, were being discriminated against on the basis of medically indicated testing. And really what I don't want to lose in the process here is that what we're really focusing now and we're looking at very intently is research applications. And although the law never intended, ever intended, to get in the way of research, any legitimate medical research, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that every one of us in this room have undergone numerous medical tests in our lives, and it's very possible even genetic tests in our lives, and you haven't even known that. But very few of us in this room have participated in research. So we don't want to hurt the research enterprise, but we want to make sure we maintain the medical enterprise, which is most dependent on this law. And with that said, you know, I think that these five consensus elements really bring a lot to the table, and I do think it's a tremendous step forward. But there's a lot of ways to accomplish these five, and that's reflected in Senate Bill 1008 and 937. Because in one way or another, 937 and 1008 both address these five points, but they do it in a different manner. And we realize this is a very complex issue, and unfortunately, we wish we could take pen to paper and come up with a very simple document for you, but it's not that easy. And the Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Group has been working for the past year and a half, 2 years actually, with OHSU to come up with language that really reflects what is necessary for OHSU to have a viable research enterprise, and at the same time, for us to be able to deliver the standard of the quality of medicine, medical care that we do deliver right now. So I just want to stress that I think it's important that in this interim process, this next week, when we actually get locked in a room and have to put pen to paper and come up with something, that for instance, groups such as the OMA that represents the physicians ordering the tests, for medical tests, that they're represented, that they have a voice in this process, because really they represent the largest constituency of physicians that are responsible for ordering the tests that are being used medically. And really in closing, I'd just like to say that, you know, my commitment to this, I will be back, and I have a lifelong commitment to this because I'm a geneticist. And it really goes back to my training in the mid-70s when I was a student in New York City and where I firsthand experienced the discrimination and persecution that black Americans felt because they were tested through public health screening programs for sickle cell anemia, a genetic test that resulted in genetic information that resulted in these individuals losing their jobs, their insurability, and for that matter, even access to entry into the armed forces at a time when the armed forces was begging for people to enter. And so I really think that it's important that we really underline the fact that this is going to be an evolving process. The vehicle for this cannot necessarily be a trivial, simple solution. It is going to be a complex law. But I think we have a very good group of committed people here that are really trying to do the best to reach a consensus and to come up with something that will work.
Well, thank you. And my intent in the interim is to chair an interim Judiciary Committee, probably a joint one with the House. I don't want to chair the Budget Committee again and write a budget. Someone else can do that. So that'll, if that happens, then this will be one of the things I'll put on the list that we'll continue to monitor. Bruce, did you have anything to add? All right, we'll see you Tuesday and Thursday. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1008 and 937 and open work session on Senate Bill 1125. I don't intend to move this today, but we did basically a tap on this. And I see some familiar faces. Tom Tung, are you here on this? Well, please come forward. Don Palmer and another gentleman. Ah, welcome. And we'll also invite, we'll have other witnesses too later on. We'll have Al Leitner and anyone else who wants to testify on this. So, committee, I drafted this, and it was one of those bills that came to me late, and I had 48 hours, and I read it, and it wasn't what I wanted, but the legislative council couldn't make changes. So what you have before you is not what I intended to be the bill. As a preface, last session we passed 1036, which was a bill I sponsored, and I think a very good bill. And I intend to use this bill as a vehicle for a review of that process to see what we did right and what we did wrong, and that's what we're going to hear about today. So who would like to begin?
I guess I'd like to start, and just as a quick introduction, and Mr. Chair, thank you very much for your summary of the previous bill, and I appreciate the committee's attention. 1036 was a start for fairness and balance between condemning agencies and property owners.
Don, could you identify yourself?
Pardon me. My name is Don Palmer. I'm a real estate appraiser and consultant with the firm Palmer Gross and Pietro. I practice in condemnation. I probably spend about 80% of my time dealing with condemnation law. As the chair has done a good job of analyzing the current situation, Senate Bill 1125 is a great opportunity to add some additional changes that will just further create that balance between property owners and condemning agencies. Mr. Stark and Mr. Tung are practicing attorneys, and I think they can articulate some of these unique changes we'd like to have.
Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Donald Stark. I'm a practicing attorney in Portland, Oregon. I've spent 45 years in condemnation law. That's about the only thing I've done for all that period of time. I started working across the mall over here at the Oregon Department of Transportation, condemning for the Transportation Department, and tried cases for them for a number of years. And since that time, I've done the work for the Portland Development Commission that condemned hundreds of properties in Portland, and most recently the TriMet Westside Light Rail. I've also had, on occasion, but to a lesser extent, representation of individuals whose property was being condemned. Normally that was because of ODOT being a non-conflict for me, because I've done most of the work for the cities and the counties and the special districts in the Portland metropolitan area and condemning property. So I look at Senate Bill 1125 and the previous bill, which was turned out to be 35-346, from a standpoint of both sides of the issue, from the standpoint of a condemnor as to whether it's an unreasonable hardship to comply with the provisions of that law, and from the standpoint of the property owner who is basically entitled to just compensation and to a fair shake in arriving at that just compensation. And I think that there was an attitude of allowing the both sides to look freely at the appraisals that were being produced and to encourage the settlement of the cases with full disclosure on both sides as to what was involved. We've now had the previous bill 35-346 not many cases since October of last year. I think it became for the first time effective for cases filed after that time. So we haven't even seen all of the ramifications of this, but we do see problems with it from both standpoints. And there is a letter before you, I think, from my now partner. I just recently joined Bowles and Hauser and Bailey from my own private firm. And John Junkin wrote that letter, and I'm not with him at this time. I would not mind going over the proposals that I feel need to be addressed in the 1125 at this time, if that needs your approval. As far as the proposals that we have to deal in at Senate Bill 1125, we've numbered seven different areas of concern. Number one is the pre-filing offer, and in the previous bill, a condemnor, at least by interpretation of ODOT, was required to supply an appraisal to the property owner 60 days before a condemnation case could be filed. And the question of a need for immediate filing for reasons that don't appear on the bill was not provided. So, and with ODOT, that wasn't a particularly big problem, I don't think, because normally their projects are planned years ahead, and they can timeline them back the 60 days and say, we'll start here in order to get our contractor in possession up here. But with cities, I think it's created a problem in that we have emergencies for cities all the time. In fact, ODOT has some, but the landslide where you must get on the property to prevent further damage. A situation where the citizens of the district or city desire to buy a piece of property for a park, and it's threatened to be logged, and they need to file and get possession of the property to stop that. Now, these are two examples that happen, and there are other needs for an immediate possession. So we propose to provide that in cases of such emergency that an affidavit filed with the court would allow you to go ahead and make your filing within the 20-day period, not less than 20 days, but less than the 60 days in order to meet those kinds of emergencies. And from a condemnor standpoint, I think that's an important process. We talked about immediate possession, too, in here, and I've never had a case for a public condemnor that needs immediate possession that didn't go through the process of filing a motion for immediate possession and giving the property owner the opportunity to be heard on whether or not there's a hardship involved in it. Very often a property owner may find that there isn't any real need to condemn the property, and he can raise that issue at a question of early possession, and it's often done. It's done in a lot of city urban renewal cases, and that sort of thing, where choices are maybe being made that issue could be raised in. With the highway department, they have never used that process. They deposit the money into court, send a letter that it's there and that they're now entitled to possession, and then go into possession. I think the balance should require ODOT to follow the same procedure that the rest of the state follows and require the filing of a motion of immediate possession and affording the property owner an opportunity to be heard before the court on whether or not that's proper. So that's our second point of amendment. The third point is the question of 30-day offer. And under the existing condemnation law, a condemnor can make an offer, the case having been pending for a year, can make an offer 30 days before trial. And that impacts the question of whether costs and fees are going to be paid to a property owner. The offer is often withdrawn by its terms in ODOT cases. I've seen it as little as 3 days for the party, for the person to respond to the offer. And if they don't, the offer is withdrawn. And it almost inevitably that raises the need to go to trial on the case. So we're proposing that that offer be increased to 60 days, and I don't see it's a hardship for condominiums, cities, counties, state, or anyone to provide that offer 60 days before the trial of the case, and to hold that offer open for 30 days. That still gives both sides the opportunity to prepare a case for 30 days, which is ample, and is fair in giving the property owner the a chance to look at that all the appraisals, which we've asked to be included in that offer, so that they can make an intelligent choice whether they're going to go forward, hire an appraiser or two appraisers, and hire an attorney and spend that money, or to accept the offer. On the present bill, the property owner's appraisal has to be given to the other side 60 days before trial, and the trial date is not clear, whether it's the one that was set or the one that where the actual trial is going to occur. But the problem with that time frame is this, that 60 days before trial, the parties have not exhausted their opportunities to settle the case. And they haven't done so because they've never received what I just described as the 30-day offer from ODOT. They have no idea what they're going to get when that offer comes from ODOT. What we're doing is switching that, so ODOT gives the 60-day offer, and the property owner gets the opportunity to decide whether to go forward and spend the additional money to litigate the case or stop at that point and settle it. And the problem with the laws that exist is that the property owner that wants to go forward has now spent a considerable amount of money for attorney fees and appraiser fees without still knowing what the offer is going to be 30 days before trial. Often that offer is designed to reimburse all costs and attorney's fees and the original offer. So here the property owner, he's out. He gets nothing more out of it, and the only thing that would be added is the cost and fees. So I think that that process needs to be changed to give that property owner a fair shake at deciding legitimately whether to go forward or not. I'm going to let Tom Tung respond to the rest of these points in here. He's
having Thomas, you want to add anything else to the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Thomas Tung. I'm a Portland attorney, members of the committee. I do trial work, and as offer trial lawyers, we evolve in our practice into different kinds of trial work, and in recent years I've been representing property owners and only property owners in condemnation cases. We've seen big cases and we've seen small cases. The corporations and the large landowners can take care of themselves in condemnation cases. What we're talking about here in this bill is the average citizen whose house or each property or lot is being affected. And it's not a large taking, but it's very important to them. And they are confronted with the state, city, or county taking their property. And they get a letter in the mail, and it says, here's how much we're going to give you, and that's that. You either take it or we sue you. And terrified, they come in and say, what do we do? And about all we can say is that it's not really very fair. All we can do is help make it less fair. Well, less unfair. The purpose of this amendment, this list, is to help in that direction. For the small property owner, to have to hire an attorney is an expense. The Department of Transportation can then take that property owner's deposition after they filed an answer saying forth what they think the property is worth. They can get from them all the property tax objections they have filed, all the appraisals that they've ever had on the property. They can get everything that the property owner has on the property and the property owner's opinion as to what that property is worth. And then it used to be that they had to make an offer 30 days before trial to the property owner, and the property owner looked at that offer and decided whether to spend the final dollars necessary to complete an appraisal and try the case, or whether to accept the offer. Well, Senate Bill 1036 required the property owner, if it wanted to proceed to trial at all, to have to give a written appraisal to the condemning authority 60 days before trial. And that can cost $7,500, $10,000, or more. It depends on the size of the piece of property involved. But appraisers have to follow their appraisal rules. They can't use a real estate broker. They have to use an appraiser who has to follow appraisal guidelines. So they have to incur that expense, and they have to put that on the table 60 days before trial, whether they want to go to trial or not, because they haven't got the state's final offer. Then 30 days before trial, after the state has seen the cards face up from the property owner, they then can make an offer. So the economics of it are turned around against the small property owner, not intended that way, but that's the way it turned out to be. In 1036, he tried to avoid the practice of amending down, which is item number 5 here, and in balancing and trying to find some equity, there were these provisions placed in it wherein the property owner was required to place that appraisal before the condemning authority 60 days before trial. I don't think it was at all intended to do what's happening, but it has shifted the economics for these small cases. The appraisal process is a good process, but it only deals with properties of $20,000. And as property values have escalated, $20,000 isn't a lot when the average lot costs more than that. So we suggested in item number 7 that arbitration be increased to $50,000, which is the same as it is in civil cases on a county option. It's 25 mandatory, 50 county option. That's number 7. The prior bill, when it required the disclosure of experts, didn't say that they couldn't be discovered. In other words, depositions taken of them, which is more expense, because if you have an appraiser, such as Mr. Palmer, hired to appraise your property and the state wants to take his deposition, he has to prepare for that, and his professional time has to be charged for that, and the property owner gets to pay for that. Well, if the property owner wants to prepare properly, they may want to take the state's appraiser's depositions. That's unnecessary expense. In Oregon, we don't have expert discovery in civil cases. Washington and California have it. In condemnation, we have the prospect of that. I have a letter from Henry Lasby when I suggested to him that this might not have been the best effort of the legislature with regard to that issue. He said, well, you know, there may be more expense occasioned. And so part of the effort here is to make sure that that expense isn't occasioned for the small property owner. The property owner's appraisal and the government's appraisal should be both on the table. There's language that's pretty tricky in this, but it's there in that the condemning authority doesn't have to give the property owner an appraisal when the property is taken. It says any written appraisal. They can have a right-of-way agent or something of that nature give them an opinion, and that can work for them, but they don't have to have an appraisal. If they do, they have to give it if they've relied upon it. If they haven't relied upon it, they get an appraisal that they didn't like, they don't have to give that to the property owner. They can go out and find one that they do like and then give it to them, but they don't have to give them the other one. In other words, they can go out and get two and pick the lowest and not give the higher one to the property owner. That is entirely permitted under the present law. They don't have to give an appraisal with the 30-day offer. They only have to give an appraisal at the time of trial. Failure to provide the opposing copy with a copy of the appropriate appraisal prohibits the use of an appraisal at trial. Well, that hasn't been interpreted yet, but clearly if the property owner didn't give an appraisal 60 days before trial, they wouldn't be able to use an appraisal. So the property owner is sitting there without an appraiser if this case goes to trial. And that isn't fair, because he didn't know that the state was only going to offer X 30 days before trial. So he's sitting there blind. He has to know whether to spend $5,000 or $10,000 on appraisal or accept the previous offer that may not be on the table. So we've got a situation for small property owners in the state that I think we need some equity, and those are the people that I represent, and it's for those reasons that I would urge you to consider the amendments 1 through 7.
When it's a large amount, a big piece of property, of course, experiences immediately, the property owner gets an appraisal. But you're right, on something that's smaller, you don't because of the cost. And in my experience in primarily dealing with the city of Bend, Chutes County, or ODOT as they built the Bend Parkway, generally if it's under $100,000, you try not to hire a Don Palmer because of the expense. Not that his fees aren't reasonable, it's true, but it costs money. And so you go into a negotiation stage and you talk to realtors who will give you an opinion over the phone, but of course they can't be expert witnesses to get you a feel for what the property is worth. You negotiate with the right-of-way officer and you try and come up with something, and then if you don't agree, then ODOT will file the complaint. They have to take the head of the money in the court and take it out and what they offer. And then you get very serious and you're incurring attorney fees and go through that process. The reason I mention that is I'm thinking that this is a possible compromise. If the value is less than $100,000, maybe making the reversal that you just talked about from the existing law effective. I'm just throwing that out as an idea. Would that make sense or alleviate most of the problem?
Mr. Chair, it would help for the small property owner to be sure. I do think, though, that we probably ought to have the same equity regardless of whether it's a $150,000 lot or a $50,000 lot. Drawing a line of that way. And, of course, then is it because the state thinks it's worth so much or the property owner thinks it's so much? These lines on a dollar amount sound better than they are. I've tried large cases where we've had very great differences of opinion, and we understand what those differences are, but I've tried large cases where we don't really see the issues until we're at the courthouse for reasons that are understandable between ODOT's counsel and the AG's office and our firm and others. I do think that mediation is now available and used in these cases. There's opportunity for discussion, and I think that that is an avenue that we would hope that the Department of Transportation would utilize more, but it requires full disclosure. The core here that's the problem is that they don't have to release all of the appraisals that they obtain. They don't. They only have to release the ones that they're relying upon. Now, that is the same for big or small property owners. They don't have to have an appraisal before they take the property. We think they should have an appraisal from an independent appraiser before they set the value, rather than wait until right before trial, after they've seen the property owner's appraisal, before they go out and get an appraiser to try to justify the figures that they have. So we're asking that the state is going to take any property, large or small, get an appraisal up front, and all appraisals that they get turn over to the property owner with the taking.
I'm not sure this is the best analogy, but I'm just thinking back to my vast few years experience, I'm saying that a little tongue-in-cheek, at doing custody cases, and I remember having some custody cases where we hired experts to evaluate my client, as the case may be, in hopes that they would be the favored choice of the court in terms of a custodial parent. And we didn't always like the results of some of those evaluators, so we didn't use them, and we, of course, weren't required to provide the evaluation to the other side. Why would this be any different? I mean, why can't someone go out and hire numerous experts, you know, use those experts, get information for those experts, and then choose which experts to use at time of hearing? I guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I would agree with your comments. Traditionally, in the Oregon practice, you get to pick your expert, and you don't have to tell the other side who you've looked to or talked to or anything else. But if the idea here is to promote settlement by putting all the cards face up on the table, requiring the condemning authority and the property owner to present their appraisals, if there is an appraisal, then it should be with equity in both sides. Now, the condemning authority gets to hire the appraiser, mind you, and they are a very sophisticated purchaser of appraisal services, the condemning authority is. And if they get a bad appraisal, in their opinion, from somebody, they won't hire that person again. So they may make the mistake once, Senator Brown, but they probably won't make the mistake again.
Well, we want to use taxpayer dollars efficiently, I presume, is the motivating factor there.
We do, but it doesn't do any good to prolong the process. If they get a good appraisal up front that's credible and independent, the cases will resolve. Lawyers will be out of work, and people will be happy.
Thank you.
Mr. Palmer and the appraisals will have, a little more work in the front, and that's fine.
Senator Brown, there is a difference in condemnation law that you might know, and that's that
I don't.
They do have to disclose who their appraisers are at the time that they examine the property.
Okay.
There are no secrets by ODOT appraisers. We know who they are.
Don, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I don't think what's been proposed is going to add huge dollars to the taxpayers. But this process, in my opinion, just offers an opportunity for fairness and balance between both the condemning agencies and the property owners, with all information being sort of handled at the same time. So I really see this as some really major steps. The amount of properties that go to this extent are unfortunately probably not that many. But when you do go to that level, it can be very expensive for the property owner if we have to work with an existing law.
Thank you for your testimony. I'd invite Al Leitner and Al Beckenbrock. Also, I see Bill Penhollow out there with the yellow pad. So, welcome. Go. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Al Leitner. I'm with the Department of Transportation, the Right-of-Way Project Administration. I wasn't quite sure what to be prepared for today. I brought testimony that would address the bill as written. It was my understanding that our work group was going to be in action and we were going to be working on that. So then I had some testimony that talked of what the work group was going to be setting about and to do. And then I was also going to be willing to go through what our process is. And I believe that would be very helpful in light of the testimony that we all just heard. So if I could beg your indulgence to go through and explain what the Oregon Department of Transportation does and how we implemented Senate Bill 1036. Cities and counties may not do it exactly that way, but I went around the state last year and held seminars and invited cities and counties and told them what it was that we were going to do and tried to provide some insight into the hearings that we had.
A quick question, just sort of for background and perspective. Did you all oppose 1036 last session? Or
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, we did not oppose it. We were neutral, but we had some very serious concerns in the early part, and through very intense work, we were very supportive of 1036 in its entirety in its final form. And still are. There are really two areas of statute that condemnation falls within, Chapter 281 and Chapter 35. The amendments that were made under 1036 occurred in Chapter 35, but to those of us who administer an acquisition program, we've kind of got two areas of statute that tells us what to do. And so just looking at what Chapter 35 does doesn't explain at all, and there may be some confusion there. So let's go through it. First thing we do, under Chapter 281, there are 9 policy areas that are prescribed by federal law that we have to follow. They talk of timely notice, fair appraisal, and a number of these items. We subscribe to those and we follow those. So away we go. First thing we do is we send out a written notice to all property owners that may be affected by a project. The Transportation Commission reviews that project and passes a resolution as to the necessity of the properties and files that resolution for condemnation authority. If the properties are needed, if they're necessary. And so that is where we establish that. We then give a 15-day notice to the property owner that an appraiser will be contacting them, and they will have 15 days notice to prepare the property for inspection. And that 15 days is a Senate Bill 1036 feature. And we hire fee appraisers. We hire perhaps 400 to 500 a year, and spend somewhere between $700,000 and $800,000 a year in private fee appraiser services, Mr. Palmer and company. The evaluation is done. A full appraisal is done. If it's a property, right now, administratively, we say if it's under $10,000, we have an administrative determination that's based on market data. It's done by a qualified appraiser. It does not rise to a fully documented appraisal, but it does cover all market data. On very complex properties of high value, we usually get 2 appraisals. Simply under the notion that it's good to have 2 opinions. There is a very rare exception to where we might have order another appraisal on something of a lesser value. One that I can think of recently, we did that. We simply could not get the appraisal produced from that individual in a timely manner. They were non-responsive. There are a number of problems, and we had to go out and hire a second. So, yes, indeed, sometimes we do have 2 appraisals. But we go on, we make our initial written offer based upon the appraisal or the valuation that pertains. Sometimes we have fixed-year appraisals, 2 other appraisals. I mean, you're talking a lot of information. Some of it's just absolutely irrelevant and absolutely useless. Like I say, we had to order a second one perhaps, again, very rarely. That appraisal that the offer is based on or the administrative determination sheet is attached and is given to the owner or their attorney without fail. And that was a requirement of Senate Bill 1036. The property owner now has 40 days to seriously consider that offer, and the 40 days is a provision of Senate Bill 1036. That 40 days can be waived if there is an emergency, and it has to be declared by the road authority, and it goes through certain statutory steps. The Legislative Council was very careful to set that out in 1036 last session, so I believe emergencies are covered by this. Okay, up until that point, everything I've said results in an 85% success rate for us. 85 out of 100 folks that we deal with, we settle with at that point, and everyone's pleased. If we cannot reach an agreement, we then send out what we call a final legal letter. It's sort of our last plea of, we offer you this amount, and under Chapter 35, that letter goes to all parties of interest. They have 20 days to consider that. That's under old law. So now they've had 60 days to consider our offer before we are able to file a complaint. And that was the intent of 1036, was to give property owners 60 days minimum to consider our offers.
If it's declined, we send our complaint to the court, ask for a case number, they send it back. With that case number, we then draw a deposit for that amount of money and send the deposit into court and notification of the case number to all individuals of record. And we also notify them when we are entitled to possession. We may not always take possession immediately. Sometimes relocation is involved and some other issues. So we do declare when possession, we're entitled to possession there. Okay, all of that takes place, and it hasn't gone over to the Department of Justice yet. That's within the Department of Transportation across the way. So now we send it over to Department of Justice. The complaint has been filed under 1036. From that point on, any appraisal that we get must be shared. The words that were said was, we don't want ODOT going on any fishing expeditions, and we suspect you do. And so that is why that's in there. That was the protection that was put in there. And that is what we do. Okay. In this period of time after we filed the complaint, our agents keep working with the owner and their attorney, and we settle 11% of those 15% that went over there. So now we're down to 4% that everybody we deal with still hasn't quite been reconciled with. The Department of Justice staff settles with those other three. That leaves less than 1% that's now going through the process of what do we do to get ready to go to trial. The resounding success of Senate Bill 1036 is in the feature of where we have made all of our appraisals at the time of complaint, at the time of initial offer, the one we relied upon, any other appraisal that we got after the complaint, we now are at a point where if they are serious about their demands, and they always say they are, that in order to facilitate settlement, we're going to make one more offer 30 days before trial. If we're going to make an intelligent, well-reasoned offer as an agency that is responsive to what their contentions are, then we should be entitled to fair disclosure of their appraisal or other information that they base that. So that is why the feature was put into 1036. 30 days prior to our 30-day offer, we get to see their appraisal or the information that, that they've based their demands on. And so that's where the 60-day, we get to see the appraisal 60 days. That was the equal disclosure feature that was very important. And quite frankly, I think that's led to tremendous successes. So now, like I say, we're down to 1%, less than 1% actually go through trial. I believe last year we had maybe two that actually went through trial, two cases, and we acquire maybe 700 properties a year. I think Senate Bill 1036 has been a tremendous help to us. We send out questionnaires to all the people that we deal with, and our approval rating is 80 to 90%. About 80 to 85% are good to excellent as far as trust and satisfaction with how they were treated by ODOT. And those questionnaires were made part of the record last year, or last session. I could go back through some of this, but I think I've covered it enough. Changes made by Senate Bill 1036 the last session are proving to be of real benefit to Oregonians. Minor technical amendments or adjustments to clarify current law in this area can be of benefit. There are some areas that are a bit confusing because it jumps back and forth between two different chapters. Major overhauls that retreat from the balance of progress that we attained under 1036 should be approached with the utmost care.
Let me talk to you about those, what I consider some fairly technical changes. Do you have any objection to upping the arbitration to $50,000?
Chair Bryant,
speaking for the Department of Transportation, I don't. It goes up fast for others. I know that was part of the discussion 2 years ago that I believe some of the cities had indicated that that would be a limit that would cause them some problems. That we did have the split between 20,000 on non-binding and up to 50 on, or 20,000 on binding and up to 50 on non-binding. So I would certainly say that is an area for adjusting. But that's an ODOT comment.
And on the discovery, I never intended that there'd be depositions of the appraisers. Do you have any problem in clarifying that?
I'm not exactly sure what it is that they're driving out there. I do know it seems to me that if you have someone contending that a property is worth $250,000, that somehow that person's opinion ought to be able to be investigated a little bit. And I'm not an attorney, so I don't know if I'm off base on that, but I'm...
Of course, you'd have the appraisal in hand to see how that opinion was arrived at. The other one, it was, on the pre-filing offer, the condemners would have they'd be entitled to all appraisals that were done prior to the filing. Do you have an objection to that, or do you, right now, you just have to provide the appraisal that was used for making the offer?
Mr. Chair, the appraisals, I can't think of a case where any appraisal that we retained would be in any way damaging in any way, shape, or form to us. I'm certainly not avoiding doing that. The other language that accompanies that may start shifting the timing of when appraisals are exchanged or available, and that's what I would be somewhat cautious about. This seems to be an area that, as far as the timing, that is a little bit bumpy, if I'm sensing it right.
Under current law, and what we passed last time, it was 20 days prior to filing, and the suggested amendment is 40 days, unless there's an emergency, and then you can file sooner by filing the affidavit, as I understand what was proposed.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess that's where I'm confused. In my mind, I see us having submitted our appraisal, weeks and months prior to this filing of the complaint. And any new appraisal that we get after filing the complaint has to be made available. So I stumble over some of that process. And I think that's some of the clarification that I talk about. I'm not certain folks are all clear, at least maybe I'm not clear on who wants what 40 or 20 days in what order.
Well, I think the proposal is that the condemner would file a written offer at least 40 days before filing. That offer would be accompanied with all appraisals. And upon showing of an emergency or other exigent circumstance, the condemner could file a complaint not less than 20 days following presentation of a written offer. So it gives you, if you have a reason for going back to the 20 days, you can. So I think that's what the proposal is from the proponents. 40 days standard, but then going to the 20 if you've got a good reason for the 20 days.
I'd be willing, Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to look at that again. When it speaks of its written offer, I've sensed there's confusion. Do they mean our initial written offer that was first shot out of the box way back when, or the one that's the final legal letter offer? It strikes me as not clear.
Well, even with your first offer, you have to provide a copy of the appraisal, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then with your offer before if there is another one, before you file the complaint? Is it your practice to include, or you'd have to include any new appraisal that you're basing your offer on under current law?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And if your final offer before filing the complaint is based upon the same appraisal, you
wouldn't have to provide that again. It'd be just duplicative. And then if you wanted, the other suggestion is if you want immediate possession, then you can do that, but you need to file a motion with the court requesting that, which I assume that you normally would do anyway if you want immediate possession. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair, that is not. We, like I say, the resolution for necessity was made early in the process. And this would be another, in my opinion, it would be another way for someone to resist and go through the same public process that's already been gone through in the public hearing process. And I believe, at least for the Department of Transportation, it would start being counterproductive.
Question? Okay. Mr. Cameron.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. Today I am pinch hitting for Mr. Paul Snyder, who is involved in another committee. I would just like to indicate to the committee that we have been having discussions with Dan Olson, who is the county council in Washington County, regarding Senate Bill 1125 and the seven proposals that have been advanced. Mr. Olson has had discussions with Mr. Junkin as recent as this week. The note that he faxed to Mr. Snyder indicated that there were still some questions that were left unresolved in that discussion, and so I'm feeling a little bit anxious about moving ahead with this bill without having some opportunity later to involve Mr. Olson, Mr. Snyder.
We're not going to move the bill today.
Okay.
And that'll give the work group an opportunity to get together and talk one more time to see where there can be consensus, and then we can bring it back again.
Very good.
Next. Very good.
And Mr. Chair, in our meeting yesterday, members of the informal work group, I guess you could call it, agreed to a conference call on Monday at 3:30, 3 o'clock. Just shout it out. What time was that? Okay.
She's got so many work groups.
I knew that I couldn't be there because I was in another work group. So Monday afternoon, and perhaps Mr. Leitner, maybe you can make sure that the gentlemen behind you are aware of that, as well as Mr. Penhall, in terms of what your ranges for getting hold of each other.
Okay. That was 1:30. 1:30
on Monday or Tuesday? You know what? Talk to Al. I'm sure he's got it down.
All right. I'll wait back to
the court. It doesn't blow up.
And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We are adjourned. I'm
okay.